They had evidently been people of good social position on Earth, and their clothes, though dirty and torn, had at one time been expensive and fashionable. Yet these two fought like any people from the slums might have done, and as we watched, the man, who was evidently the stronger willed, dashed the woman to the ground between the seats. He deliberately stamped upon her and then sat down on his seat and used her body as a footstool, pounding her every now and then, if she attempted to rise. Seeing us, he signaled us to pass him, adding, "Don't mind her, just walk over her. I like to make a carpet of her, it does her good." To emphasize this, he gave her a savage kick in the jaw. We walked across her to some seats beyond him which were vacant. It was a most extraordinary sensation, for her body felt like real flesh and blood, and she squirmed and shrieked as if alive. Of course, she really did feel sufferings similar to those she would have felt on Earth under the circumstances. But though our actions here show forth our wills, it is our wills which inflict the pain. Gone West 102. Seated next to us were two women. Handsome they must have been at one time, but they were rendered hideous by the expression of the most fiendish cruelty which overspread their faces. Their eyes were steel blue-gray, and their hair golden in hue. I surveyed them carefully for a minute or two, and then the one nearest to me, who said her name was Rose, spoke. "Well, I seem to fascinate you. What do you think of me?" I answered, "I think you were handsome once, but your cruelty has spoilt your looks. Still, one can't be too particular in hell. You'll do, and your friend also. I shall take you both." "Well, we've got to be consulted first," she replied, "and I don't intend to go with you." I seized her hands at once. "Down on your knees and place your neck beneath my heel," I hissed. For a brief moment she tried to resist, then fell groaning and sobbing at my feet, and did as I bade her. "Now sit back in your seat and remember you are my slave," I said, and then, addressing the other, continued, "What's your name?" "Violet." "Indeed, a pretty name like your companion's, especially for such a cruel devil as you are. However, I'm more savage still, so you had better obey me at once. Down on your knees and do as Rose did." She did so without a murmur. After a little desultory conversation, the curtain rose and the noise of quarreling gradually subsided as the plot unfolded itself. I do not propose to give you that plot. It suffices to say that though lust and vice of every description were there enacted in full detail before our eyes, it passed to its culminating point in the torture chamber of the Inquisition. My male slave, who had been sitting quietly up to now, here whispered, "We had better fly now, master." At the end of this scene, the inquisitors invariably raid the audience and carry some of them onto the stage to torture them. Even as he ceased, the Grand Inquisitor stepped forward, and, pointing at him, cried, "Come here, wretched man!" And the miserable creature, with livid terror written on his features, rose, and, as if drawn against his will, began to make his way out of his seat and towards the stage. I at once resented this, for he was my slave, and, once taken from me, I might not be able to recover him. It was an open assault on my domination, and I could not permit it. I rose at once. "Let that man alone, he is mine. If you want to torture someone fresh, torture yourself." A low shriek of excitement passed round the theatre as the audience scented a fierce battle. The chief inquisitor glared at me. "You are evidently a stranger here, or you would not dare to thus openly defy me. Well, it's time you learnt your first lesson. Come up onto this stage and do battle with me." "No, come down here," I answered, and then began a fierce battle between our wills. I have always had an iron will, and it stood me in good stead that day. The magnetic attraction sent out from the stage was tremendous, but I successfully resisted and willed that he should come to me. For a long time we thus struggled, when suddenly a yell broke from the audience. My enemy had been compelled to move a step forward. Next instant, however, he had sprung back again, and I felt myself jerked forward sharply. The yell, "Gone West 103, from the audience had made my mind wander for a moment, but at once I redoubled my efforts, and ere long again he stepped towards me. This time, however, there was no return. Again another step, and then he began to move slowly towards the edge of the platform. At the edge he hesitated and struggled desperately, then with a wild shriek pitched forward into the orchestra, the members of which scattered in all directions. A wild yell of delight arose from all who saw it. Then he rose and crawled slowly towards me, climbing over the stalls, and the audience got out of his way, for they still feared him. At length he knelt on the stool in front of me. Then I spoke, "Go back to the stage, and I will follow." I drove him before me, now completely beaten, vaulted lightly onto the stage, and there made his assistant inquisitors inflict all their most devilish torments upon him. The applause was deafening, and when we had seen enough and I turned to get down from the stage, a great shout arose, "You shall be our emperor, raise the standard of revolt against the tyrant." But it did not suit me to enter at once on conflict with that powerful will. I needed to know more about this city before I attempted anything so risky. At the same time I knew that the conflict was bound to come, and knew also that it would be impossible to hide for long what had happened at the theater. Once the emperor knew what had happened, he would scent danger and take measures accordingly. I therefore replied, "Silence, I have no wish to rule here. So long as I am not attacked by him, I shall remain loyal to the emperor." At these words a titter ran round the building, and several murmured, "He's afraid." "Silence, you dogs," I shouted. "If you breathe one word of what has happened here, I will inflict the most horrible tortures on you that it is possible to imagine." "The emperor will defend us from you," yelped a man in the stalls. In an instant I had him on the stage and bade the inquisitors flay him alive. If I use such material language, it is because by no other means can I convey what was done. It looked like flaying to the audience, and felt like it to the man, but of course there was no physical skin to flay. Nevertheless, the result was the same. Then I dismissed the spectators, and, calling to me the two women and my slave, myself left the building. "I suppose you can find me a house?" I inquired of the man. "Yes, master." "What of this one?" "It belongs to a well-known murderer, an Italian of the Renaissance. I think you would find it more convenient than one of the ancient Roman villas." "This will do," I answered. We hammered at the door and a manservant opened it and struck at me. In a moment I had hurled him on the floor. "Stamp on his face," I cried to my women, and Rose did so with the greatest delight. I rushed up a flight of marble stairs, all cracked and filthy, and into a large salon. Here the master at the house sat surrounded by women. I sprang at him and hurled him out of the window, and appropriated for my own use the house and all it contained, including women and servants. "Now, I think that is sufficient for this time." He rose, but I, J.W., said, "Please stop a moment. I want to ask you one or two questions. H.J.L. Thereupon remarked, "You had better be quick, for you have been here long enough." I nodded, and asked, "Can you give me any details about the gladiators which are likely to be unknown to the historians of the present day?" "Gone West 104, officer. I don't exactly know how much they know, but I expect they are fairly well up in the subject. There is, I believe, a fair amount of evidence about. Perhaps, however, you don't know this fact. The gladiators advanced on one side in a sort of triangle and on the other in a solid phalanx. As soon as the triangle or point of the wedge struck the phalanx, the latter divided like a pair of scissors and then closed on the sides of the wedge. Do you understand this?" "Quite, I, J. W., replied. "And which is the correct rendering of thumbs reversed? Is it up or down to save the man?" He smiled grimly. "I am afraid I cannot answer that query. No question of saving any gladiator ever arose. Firstly, of course, they can't die, and, secondly, no one in the city of hate ever desired to save any man from suffering. Half the interest in these shows lay in the fact that the victor tortured his conquered foe." "Now," interposed H. J. L., "you must return." Gone West 105, Chapter 9, A Visit to the Emperor, Trance Conversation, April 6th. The officer's narrative continued. "I do not think it necessary to give you in detail all that befell me in hell. I set to work to gather round me a band of adherents. From them I demanded and obtained absolute obedience, but I allowed them to patrol the streets in bands, and attack and ill-treat all and sundry who fell into their hands. Large numbers of former brigands and pirates, together with soldiers of fortune belonging to every age and country, hastened to join my bands. At length the inevitable happened. I received a summons to appear before the emperor. I went, accompanied by a number of my retainers. As soon as we entered the presence chamber, a magnificent but dirty hall, the emperor rose from his throne. This was raised up on a dais approached by three semicircular steps. He smiled at me in a manner which was meant to be engaging, but of course I could see the hatred and suspicion which was in his heart. That is one of the strangest things in that strange land. We still endeavor to deceive each other, and even think we can, although we know that others cannot really deceive us. We see the thoughts of others, and though our reason tells us that similarly others can see ours, yet some instinct still drives us on to attempt to deceive all with whom we come in contact. The emperor spoke, "Friend, you have already achieved much, seeing how short a time you have been in hell." I bowed. "Your majesty has spoken truly, and I hope to achieve even more. Even my throne," he murmured, "but I assure you, you will not find it an easy seat. Still, that time has not arrived, and will not. Come, let us be friends, you and I. We will be like David and Jonathan, and between us we will extend the dominions over which I now rule. If needs be, like Antony and Octavius, we can later fight over the spoils as to who shall own them. For the present, like those wise generals, let us unite our forces and compel the neighboring princes to acknowledge our dominion. Behold, I will make you my general, and you shall begin your career by attacking an upstart fellow called Danton who has terrorized an area near the confines of this city. It formerly belonged to another prince, but this fellow descended into hell with a large following and carved out this petty kingdom for himself. It is known as Paris of the Revolution. I saw quite plainly what was his real object. He feared to openly cross swords with me, yet felt that my constant presence near him, and yet independent of him, was a danger. He foresaw that by this means he would at any rate get me away from the heart of his empire for a time, and he, further, hoped that one of three things would result: either that I should be defeated and made a prisoner by Danton, or that the struggle would result in a draw, whereupon he could intervene and crush us both. Failing either of these, he still considered the third alternative advantageous. This was that I should crush Danton and seize his precarious throne. In that case he believed that I should be fully engaged in retaining control over my new subjects, and so be unable to hurt him. He, on his part, would merely have exchanged one enemy for another, and might even find me so weakened by the conflict that he could attack and crush me easily. But though I saw his real intentions, yet it suited me to agree. I, too, feared open struggle with the emperor. I knew only too well what failure would mean. On the other, gone West 106, hand, I felt confident that I should be able to overthrow Danton, and, having added his adherence to mine, return and attack the emperor with a far greater likelihood of success. "I accept with alacrity your majesty's gracious offer," I cried. Thereupon the emperor ordered a great feast to be prepared, and bade all the court attend. At this feast I was the honored guest. Wonderful dishes containing all manner of dainties were laid before us, but when we strove to eat them, feeling ravenously hungry and thirsty, there was nothing. The feast of Tantalus was no figment of the poet's brain, but a grim reality. Yet though it was a hollow sham, the wretched guests were compelled to pretend to enjoy the feast because the emperor demanded it. He, however, scorning to keep up the pretense which he compelled others to maintain, sat there with a sardonic smile upon his features. I, too, refused to play the game, and watched with grim amusement the efforts of the others to appear gay. Everything was but a hollow pretense. There was a large orchestra playing during the feast, but, despite their efforts, they were quite unable to produce any real harmony. It was simply a horrible discord, made all the worse by the fact that the audience were compelled to pretend they enjoyed it. After the feast, the tables were removed, and gladiators fought before the emperor. After a while, female gladiators took their places, and these fought with a ferocity and devilish cruelty which exceeded even that of the men. I will not give in detail all the amusements which graced the emperor's feast, it will serve no useful purpose. Enough to say that they included every imaginable form of cruelty and lust, and that many of them were perpetrated upon the guests themselves. Gone West 107, Chapter 10. The attack on Danton. Soon after we had left the feast, I sent out some of my retainers to issue a proclamation calling for volunteers. This brought in a considerable number, and, having mustered these, I commenced a route march through the city towards the district over which Danton was supreme. As we marched, thousands flocked to our standards, and at length, reaching an open space which looked like a piece of waste ground, such as one used to see in and near great cities, I halted them and began to divide them into squadrons and companies. Such a motley crowd, men of all ages and dimes, were gathered there, ancient Roman gladiators, crusaders and robber barons of the Middle Ages, Chinese pirates, English buccaneers, soldiers of fortune from every corner of the earth, Turks, Bulgars, there they stood and yelled in wild excitement, shouting to be led against the enemy. At times they varied this by fighting among themselves. Gradually I sorted them into divisions, and placed these under officers. Thus I grouped the medieval knights into two huge masses and divided each mass into regiments and companies. Similarly, I organized the gladiators, the buccaneers, and, indeed, all these various constituents, and produced in the end a very serviceable army. Its great fault was an almost utter lack of discipline, but this was replaced by the dominating rule of the officers I had appointed. Of course, these were constantly conspiring against me, and I had to be always prepared to crush a mutiny first in one part of the army and then in the other. Nevertheless, my will being, as you know, a remarkably strong one, I was able to dominate and lead this large force numbering over a quarter of a million. We proceeded on our way, the troops acting, as they went, in the most approved style of the worst kind of soldiery, that is, they broke into the houses as they passed, plundering and ill-treating the inhabitants. One peculiar fact which I noticed was that they seemed unable to retain possession of what they had stolen. Once they had got it, it ceased to interest them and was thrown aside almost directly. When we reached the confines of the district held by Danton, I sent forward a scouting party, who soon returned, dragging several men with them. These wore the costume in vogue at the time of the revolution, and from them I gathered a great deal of information. Of course, they tried to deceive me. But as I could see their thoughts, it failed, as it always does here in the spirit world. These people are those who lived during the revolution in France. Some of them were the supporters of Danton, others were his opponents. Their chief amusement is the guillotine, but since the object of that was to produce a quick and comparatively painless death, they have slightly altered the procedure of an execution. Of course, there is ho death in hell, and their object is to inflict as much pain as possible. They therefore place the victim on a board and slide that board under the guillotine. The man's feet, instead of his head, being in front and towards the crowd. The blade rises and falls a dozen times or more and cuts the victim in slices. The man suffers pain similar to that which he would have felt on earth, but the severed parts keep reuniting. He thus suffers over and over again all the agonies of death, but without the helping hand of that great benefactor who, on earth, puts some limit to the pain man can endure. How seldom is it that men realize how much more death is a friend than an enemy. How often have I longed for death again to come since that day on which he really came. Gone West 108, the people in this district also reenact, so far as they can, the chief episodes in the worst period of the revolution. In particular, they hold blasphemous parodies of religious services, as they did then, and continually repeat the famous Festival of Reason, bowing down in mock solemnity before the original prostitute who on earth received their plaudits. Having obtained this and more information, I drew up my plan of campaign and then advanced into the enemy's country. As we did so, we endeavored to do as much damage as possible to the houses and people we met. While we tortured and made slaves of the latter, We endeavored to utterly destroy the former. We were able to do this so long as we were near the forms of the buildings, but as soon as we moved on to some other area and ceased to be interested, the buildings reappeared. Like ourselves, they are forms and so indestructible, they merely seem to disappear, because our wills are stronger than those of the owners, for the time being, but as soon as the stronger person's will alters, or as soon as it ceases to think about them, they resume their original shape. It is similar to the fact that the emperor can compel people to assume the forms of animals. In like manner we compelled these forms to vanish, but as soon as the will that had made them vanish was withdrawn, they resumed their normal shape. We thus advanced rapidly into the enemy's country, and ere long saw the enemy's forces mustered along a ridge. I should explain that there was some open country between the city in which the emperor reigned and Paris of the Revolution. It was not really extensive, but was sufficient to act as a barrier between the two spheres of influence. It was created and retained by the determined will of Danton, or otherwise it would have soon been covered with houses. It is utterly impossible to give you even approximate measurements, as space in your sense does not exist. However, it was large enough to enable two great armies to carry out all the complicated evolutions needed in a battle. The ground itself was the most dreary waste it is possible to imagine. It was black and burnt up, and, as it were, covered with ashes. There were two ranges of hills, and Danton had taken up his position on the further, while we occupied the ridge nearest to the emperor's city. Overhead, as it always is in hell, the air was black and the atmosphere dense as with a fog. We were, however, by now able to perceive each other in spite of the fact that there was no light. I grouped my heavy guns in three main divisions. J. W. Guns. Do you mean to say you have artillery in hell? The officer. Certainly. Where do you suppose the forms of all the weapons of destruction which men are forever inventing go, if not to hell? There is no place for them in the realm of half-belief, and they must go somewhere. Well, they come to hell. Now, the really interesting feature about the matter lies in this. Men who on earth have never used rifles or, indeed, any modern weapons, are almost entirely unable to use them. These weapons are forms and the pain which they inflict in hell is mental. It appears very similar to physical pain, for that is the easiest way for us to appreciate it. A man who on earth knew nothing of the effects of a rifle wound would here find it next to impossible to imagine it. He could certainly not impose that kind of pain on another, and he would not be easily susceptible to it as imagined by another. A man who on earth has heard how a bullet hurts will be able to impose the type of suffering on another, or realize it when another tries to impose it on him. But the man who can both inflict and suffer most keenly such pain is the man who has on earth actually undergone that particular kind of torment. Hence it comes about that often the most fiendish torturers here are those who are tortured on earth. If they die unforgiving, they are enabled by the very pains they have suffered to retaliate on their old oppressors to a most appalling degree. Gone West 109. Is this matter quite plain? J. W. Yes, I think so. A parallel case on earth is to be found in hypnotism. I gather that a hypnotist can make his patient suffer sensations and pains according as he wills it. He can make him taste a piece of lemon placed not in his own but in the hypnotist's mouth. So, too, he can impose pain, especially pain associated with the nerves, and, contrariwise, can take away the pain which the patient is really feeling. The officer. Precisely. It is of course the same power, but it can only be used on the earth plane to a limited extent, because matter interferes. Still, by careful study and practice much more might be done on those lines than is. I should add, this power can be used both to help and to harm others. Many of the ceremonies of black magic are based on this principle. Thus, the wax doll with pins driven into the spot where the lungs should be was merely utilized as a means by which the magician could concentrate his mind on that of his enemy, and then cause him to suffer the same pain as he had pretended to inflict on the wax doll. It was, of course, easier to cause the pain by producing disturbances in the mental, or, at any rate, the nervous system. Still, there have been a few men of transcendent will power who were able to affect matter direct, for at its highest mind is, of course, more powerful than matter. Such cases are rare on the earth plane, but become more general on this plane. You will thus realize that each body of troops employed those weapons which were familiar to it, and in like manner, for the most part, those who knew nothing of shot and shell were unhurt by them. The latter rule was not so absolute as the former, for a few men of exceptional willpower were able to inflict this type of pain of which they knew upon some of the weaker-willed among those who did not. They were, however, comparatively few. Now, though we had cannon, we had no horses, for horses are animals with each a separate soul, and not forms only, like inanimate objects. That difficulty was partly surmounted by my compelling a large number of spirits to assume the form of horses, some to draw the cannon, others to act as mounts for the cavalry. I was here copying the emperor's methods, and found it a most useful move, as it did not occur to Danton. I believe, moreover, his willpower was not sufficient to enforce such a command to any considerable extent. There are few things the spirits in hell hate more than being obliged to lose, even temporarily, their original form. To their materialistic minds it seems as if they are losing their identity. Gone West 110, Chapter 11, A Battle in Hell. Then the battle began in real earnest. Compared to it, the fighting in the arena had been the innocent make-believe of children. Nearly all these men had been used to fighting all their lives. The battle, to a casual observer, would have appeared much like a battle on Earth, save for the curious blend of all kinds of weapons and costumes. The armor-clad knights charged again and again, and were met by solid phalanxes of Republicans armed for the most part with scythes. Danton was quite wily enough to know that against men who knew nothing of shot and shell these modern methods of destruction would be comparatively harmless. His scythe-armed rabble, on the other hand, would have been useless against our rifles, for most of them did know something of the pain which a bullet can inflict. Many, indeed, had been shot at various times, though the majority had fallen before the guillotine. Their scythes, on the other hand, were just the sort of weapon with which to meet horsemen. The Roman gladiators rushed forward in a solid phalanx to meet a regiment who charged up the hill with bayonets fixed. The enemy's artillery answered our own, but, being almost exclusively of the date of the revolution, was not as effective as some of our guns. In this, indeed, was alike the strength and the weakness of Danton's army. It was much more coherent, and was kept together not merely by his dominating will, but by a sympathy of interests and history, and of course my force lacked these useful adjuncts. On the other hand, he was unable to employ any of the more modern weapons of destruction, while I could. So the battle raged for what seemed years. The plain between the two ranges was covered with what appeared to be wounded and dying men, and the screams of anguish rose even above the roar of the guns. I should add that the flame which leapt out every time a gun was fired was visible, but yet produced no light, that is, nothing which illuminated the surrounding darkness. But my forces not only outnumbered Danton's, but, on the whole, exceeded them in ferocity, and at length I was able to force back his left wing and then drive him from his position into the plain. Here his army was caught between my triumphant right wing, now occupying their former position on the ridge, and the remainder of my army, which still held the range nearest the emperor's city. Here they were completely shattered, and such as could attempted escape down the valley to our left, the other three sides being closed. This plan shows you the final position. He sketched out roughly, as it were with fire, the following plan. Gone West 111, Plan of the Battle. The number of our prisoners was enormous, for very few succeeded in escaping to our left. My first act was to compel a large number of them to assume the shape of horses, and so release my own men. I did this not out of consideration for my own men, but because I thus was enabled to make it to the interest of my men to concentrate their will on keeping them prisoners. We then hurled ourselves upon the town and stormed it. I should have told you that quite a considerable proportion of Danton's army consisted of women, and these fought with even greater ferocity than the men. Consequently, when they fell into the hands of my victorious troops, the tortures they inflicted on these women beggar description. We, of course, sacked Paris of the revolution as completely and thoroughly as it was possible for the most savage soldiery to do. We spared the inhabitants no suffering which could be devised.